Really glad to be here on my 5,124th day clean. I'd like to thank, the CPRNA Convention Committee for inviting me down to share on One Is Too Many. And I really can share on that topic. When I first got here, it was 1985. It took me 8 years to get 1 year clean. I just always thought that I could handle drugs. I always had this secret life that I thought nobody knew about. And I hid it for a long time. My family, didn't raise me to be an addict. Coming up, I had aspirations, I had dreams. I wanted to go to college. I went to parochial school. I had principles, I had values, and I had morals. And I didn't start out with the intention of becoming an addict. I started out trying to fit in with a new neighborhood, new friends, and having gone to Catholic school for so many years, I didn't know nothing about slang, how to dress, how to smoke a cigarette, how to go anywhere or do anything. And I felt, coming from Southeast Washington, D.C., and moving to Upper Northwest Washington, D.C., in a home in an area where black people had just started to live there, I felt very inadequate. The high school that I went to was a majority white. Now it's all black. But I felt inadequate. My grandmother started to buy things for me that I never had before. And I just wanted to fit in. So I just started doing what I saw people doing. I started listening real good so that when it was my turn, I knew what to do, knew what to say, and, knew how to respond, and I acted as if. So, eventually my choices were always the flashy, the big cars, the money, the outfits, things like that. And I got in this social club, and, we were very popular. And, I never liked drinking, but I started to drink because I wanted to fit in. And I never liked drinking. I never liked alcohol. But, people started saying, try this. And I started trying it. And I remember the first time I used narcotics. I was dating someone who was an addict. And something had gone on that day. And he said, he was sitting at the table sniffing. I didn't know what he was sniffing. And I didn't really care because I had me a glass of cherry kiafa and ginger ale. Cute little drink. So something was going on with me that day, and he was like, come over here and take a sniff of this. This will make you feel better. And it did make me feel better. And it was heroin. And I used it, and, I got sick. But I like how I felt after I got sick. I almost died. By the end of the summer, I had almost killed myself snorting heroin, because by the end of the summer, I was shooting heroin. And by the end of the summer, I had hepatitis so bad, they told me I was about to die. So, of course, I never used that drug anymore, because that drug was not the one for me. So I switched to something else. And I continued to do that. I continued to use whatever was the latest thing until I had a traumatic experience, and I said, okay, well, I can't use that no more. I got to, you know, try something else. And, excuse me, this went on for like 25 years. You know, I was introduced to Narcotics Anonymous, like I said, in 1985. And I had no idea what Narcotics Anonymous was, but he said that I had to go if I wanted to be with him. And he said, I'm going to still sell drugs in the basement, but you can stay clean. So I said, okay, boo, that's what we're going to do. And this was a relationship that had been going on for like 7 years. You know, the wife finally left, you know, and I finally felt like I had my man. And I started getting treated the way I thought he was treating his wife. You know, he cheated on me. And so I went down in the basement and I took care of all the drugs. You know, by this time I was on crack. After that incident, my whole life spiraled downward, because when that happened, I still had a car, I still had furniture, still had jewelry, still had clothes, still had that apartment building that he bought for me, still had my good government job, I still had the fashion fair that made me look good after I stayed up all night, you know. And I was going to work on a regular basis. But the pain of losing that relationship and losing that trust was too overbearing for me. Because I had been to treatment, but, you know, I didn't think I needed long-term like they said. I really didn't, you know, because I still had some stuff. And so I didn't stay but 10 days, you know. And, you know, I did go to the meeting with him right after we snorted some coke. So, you know, I thought I was okay. But the pain of losing that relationship was more than I could bear. I'd already been through two abusive marriages, let me say that. Very, very abusive, physically. Emotionally and mentally, but mostly physical. And I just, you know, I'm 30-something years old, and I'm just like, I don't know what to do. I have no clue what to do, because I'm out of the house. He done kicked me out. All my furniture's in there. I don't know what to do. What do I tell my family happened to my stuff? What do I tell my daughter why she can't go get her stuff? I didn't know. So I was homeless. And I used to that feeling for a long, long time, until one day my aunt said, why are you still worrying about that stuff? Get some more stuff. And that's what I was using to, because he took my stuff, you know, and he did me wrong. And I thought my life was over. And that, just that one phrase that she said to me gave me some hope. And I said, okay, I'm going to try. And I started going to meetings. You know, after I had been to the psychiatrist, to the doctor, counseling, at work, my family looking for me, saying, can't you just stop? Why don't you just stop? What is wrong with you? To the people on my job, walking the other way when they see me, to being blackballed on my job for a year. They didn't give me no work for a whole year. And for real, I wasn't capable of doing any work, because I was using on my job, my lunch hour. It was bad. I started staying off work a lot, when I was at work, I was not productive. I remember the last time, one time I got a check, and I had the girl bring it to the crack house. I was like, this is when you still could get your check in your hand. You know, you can't do that now. This is when they would give you your check, and you could take it and go where you want. And I said, bring my check over here on Kansas Avenue. And she said, you ain't got but $15. I'm like, and that was literally, after they took taxes out and everything, that was how much I made an hour. And I was like, that's all? She was like, yeah, and I had already spent my check, you know. So that night wasn't a good night for me at the crack house. That night I got beat up real bad because I owed that man money. And I got raped that night. And the prayer that I said while being raped was, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And I kept saying it out loud over and over. And the guy said, what is that you're saying? And I just kept saying it over and over, and he got off of me. He had me locked in a room, and he let me go. You know, I went to the police station. They had his picture. And they said, you know, you're a lucky woman, because the other girl, he beat with a 2x4 within an inch of her life. And we've been looking for him. I'm shaking now because I'm really feeling that, you know. And it was Thanksgiving Day, snow on the ground, and I walked from Kansas 5th and Kansas Avenue Northwest to Georgia Avenue and Peabody Street, which is a long way. You know, I reported that he raped me, and the police looked at me like, you know, you crackhead, you know. And that was devastating. I left my brand new car there. And it was like the end, almost the end. You know, by then I was living in a room. I was shopping at the $10 store. My daughter was in college and my son was in prison. And my family didn't want to have nothing to do with me. And I didn't know what to do. But I had hope, because I had heard the message of Narcotics Anonymous, and it never left me. I remember staying up reading this basic text, just trying to get some help, you know. So I started going to meetings, and thank God for the other fellowship, because that's where I started going, because I couldn't stand to hear y'all talk about using. You know, and after about 5 years over there, I got a grip, and I accepted that I was truly an addict. Now, I'm going to read something so that I can move on into the recovery part of my story. Thank God for Tradition 3, which says the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop using. It also says an addict who does not want to stop using will not stop. They can be analyzed, counseled, reasoned with, prayed over, threatened, beaten, locked up, but they would not stop until they want to stop. The only thing we ask of members is that they have the desire. Without it, they are doomed. But with it, miracles will happen. And today, I am truly a miracle. I have this awesome network that helps me every day. No matter what I go through, they're available to me. When I was using, I never thought that one was too many. You know, I never knew what one was too many meant. You know, I heard the cliche, one is too many, a thousand is never enough. But for real, I always said, if I ain't take that last hit, I probably wouldn't have got this messed up, you know. Or if I ain't take that last drink, because, you know, when I drank to get drunk. If six guys sent me six drinks, I was drinking all six of those. And I always left saying, dag, if I hadn't drank that last one, I'd probably be able to walk straight, you know. But for real, it wasn't the last one. It was the first one. You know, I learned that it was the first one. You know, it took a while for me to understand, what do they mean? One is too many, you know. And now that I'm not using, I got to be careful about that one is too many in other areas of my life, you know. Sometimes, I mean, right now, I have been in this funk, and I know why I'm in it. You know, I understand, but I've been in this funk like I don't need to go to the meetings no more. I don't feel like it, I don't want to, and I ain't going. But, you know, I got to remember one is too many and 1,000 is never enough. If I don't take my ass to a meeting, it's no telling what I'm going to do. You know, right now, I am in my sister's house in Clinton, Maryland. I'm 59 years old. I moved in my sister's house in January because I put one of my dreams on the back burner. And my spirit told me, you need to wake that dream up. And I wasn't putting no effort towards it, you know, but I was helping other people get to their dream. And it's very humbling because I don't like it. You know, I'm used to having my stuff around me, not other people's stuff around me. It's a sad thing when I got to go to the storage and look at my stuff. I don't like that. I don't like how I feel. You know, I don't like that I can't wear what I want to wear because most of my clothes are in storage. You know, I'm glad that it's still cold, you know, because I don't have no summer clothes. But what has happened to me is I'm in a new area. I'm in the South Potomac area, and I'm going to new meetings, and I'm meeting new people, and I'm getting a new lease on recovery. It's just, you know, amazing how God works in the background for me, doing for me what I can't do for myself. You know, I'm not driving to work. I'm riding the metro. And it helps me to get centered, you know, so that I don't go to work with that attitude that I used to have, you know, when I was had my own stuff and could do everything my own way. Now I have to be mindful. I'm in my sister's space. This is her house. What she say go, you know. And I'm learning that at work, I could do the same thing. You know, I'm getting so complacent with being quiet. I don't have all the answers. I don't have to give you an answer. I don't have to know the answer. I can just be quiet. And I want to read this because this is something that I also had to do. They say, addicts tend to live secret lives for many years. We covered low self-esteem by hiding behind phony images that we hoped would fool people. Unfortunately, we fooled ourselves more than anyone else. Although we often appeared attractive and confident, on the outside, we were really hiding a shaky, insecure person on the inside. The mask had to go. When I moved in with my sister, I had to take that mask off. You know, I'm the oldest. I've always been in charge. I always told everybody what to do. And I had to stop being who I was. I had to listen. My sister's a very intelligent person. She has a very good job, and she makes a lot of money. And her strength is one of my weaknesses. Her strength is money and managing it. And that's one of the things that I'm the weakest in. So I think I picked the right one to move in with. You know, and not only that am I learning how to do that, I'm also learning how to eat well and healthier so I can eventually stopped taking so many pills. So I guess I'm right where I'm supposed to be. I have an obsessive spirit. I like to shop. I like to eat. Everything I do, I like a lot of it. You know, I like buying movies, shoes, makeup. Love makeup. I like to have 4 or 5 different pair of glasses. I even read 2 books at a time. So, you know, so what I'm saying is one is never enough for me. You know, every time I see something, I want 2. I don't want 1. I'll be like, dang, I should get the other one too. You know, shoes, I should get them in both colors. You know, I don't know whether you can relate, but my disease is in every area of my life. You know, I will overdo everything. I will over bleach my hair. That's a secret story. That's how I ended up with locks, because I overdid it. You know, I'm trying to look good all the time. You know, bleaching my hair 2x a week and putting perm in my hair after bleaching it. And I ain't do it, and all my hair fell out. I ain't do it once. I did it 3 times. 3 times, didn't I? I did it 3 times. You know, and my daughter came up to me and said, "Mom, why you keep doing the same thing expecting a different result?" You know, and all I was trying to do was make my hair not curl up. I wanted it to be straight, but it ain't straight, it's curly. And, you know, my disease is just like, everybody's just laughing. It's so funny. I'm looking at Sean Tom. She about to pass out the chair. You know, and so I hope that somebody can understand where I'm coming from. You know, I hope that you can relate. That I'm glad that I didn't have to pay to get in here, because I probably wouldn't be here. You know, I'm glad that I'm a proud member of Narcotics Anonymous. You know, this program has helped me to grow as a woman. I'm now, even though it took me all this time, I'm who I want to be. You know, I'm who I want to be at this very moment. I am happy. I'm joyous, and I'm free. I'm free from active addiction. I don't know how much time I got. Okay, I got 10 more minutes. Let me see. Okay, let me go to another thing that I wanted to read about. We are all addicts, and that makes us one of a kind. I'm reading from We Do Recover. We all have the same thing in common. This common illness or disorder is addiction. When I first got here, I was not like y'all people. I thought I was a cut above, and I really didn't think I had a problem like y'all have. And I sat in the back because, you know, I was new, and I just assassinated the speaker. If they didn't look like I, you know, your outfit really don't match. Your hair could be another way. That's what I did, you know, and I wasn't listening to nothing nobody said. I was in my head. I also belonged, in the beginning, I belonged to a very small group at my job, a home group. And it was, most people in there, when I got there, the people with the least time, they had like double digits. So I was, you know, in there, and sometimes it might be 10 people. And I had no clue why y'all was talking the way y'all was talking, but I thought I had to talk too. So I would always be sharing, you know. And one day, I had a sponsor there, and she told me, she said, you know, I want you to stop sharing for 30 days. I said, what? She said, you're not identifying with nothing people are saying. You're just telling a story that's similar to their story. So, and she was right. She said, you're not identifying with how the person felt. You're just trying to, you know, talk. And she said, when you share from your heart. And you just speak the truth. And so the reason why I was doing that is because it was a small group, and I was trying to think of what I was going to say when y'all called on me and how good I was going to say them. And by the time you got to me, I had rustled up a couple of big words, you know, and I was sounding good to me. But my sponsor said, you know, just shut it down. Don't say anything when you go to a meeting. Because I was going, like, for the first 5 years, I went to a meeting every single day, and sometimes twice. So I said, well, what am I going to say if they call on me? Say, your name is Artis, you're a recovering addict, and you like to listen. So that's what I started doing, and I still like to listen. You know, today, my sponsor is telling me, you need to raise your hand and share because you have worked on some stuff. You got some experience, and you need to help somebody. And that's like a complete circle. You know, today I have a lovely network of people who help me stay sane. I go to meetings on a regular basis. I read the literature, and I work the steps. I have a sponsor. I have a home group, which is the 10:30 coffee hour in Washington, D.C., best home group. I like to shut it down now. I'm going to thank all of my sponsee sisters that are here for coming to help me share my experience, strength, and hope. And I hope I didn't confuse anybody. I hope I delivered a clear message of recovery, and thanks for letting me share.
For our second speaker, I give you Nate.
Hey, fam, my name is Nate, and I'm a blessed recovering addict. And it's real good to be here. Because on a day like today, I'm breathing. I got every opportunity to use, and I'm not. I'm not one of those addicts who have reasons to use. That ain't my deal. If I'm awake, I got an opportunity and a reason to use. Don't nothing have to be going on. I'm going to make something go on, and I'm going to use. That's my addiction. You know. Before, artists asked me, was I nervous, right? And I hardly ever get nervous when I have to speak, because since I've been here, I've done a lot of talking. Not in the rooms, but in the things that you guys have given me, like jobs and stuff like that, areas of responsibility, and I speak a lot. And I've come to find out what my sponsor told me early on was, when you get a chance to say something, make sure you have something to say. And make sure you tell the truth. But before you do any of that, remove you out of it and let the spirit of those in the rooms move you to say something for them. In return, you'll get something out of it. So that's what I'm going to attempt to do today. You know, this topic, when a young lady approached me and she says, Nate, let me thank the committee, first of all. When a young lady, the chairperson getting the speakers, approached me a few weeks ago and said, Nate, I want you to share your experience, strength, and hope at the convention in Ocean City. I said, cool. Been there, done that. That's a good thing. Some service. And she said, I got the perfect topic for you. One is too many. And we laughed. I don't know what her motivation was, but I know my motivation and my experience with one is too many is real, even as I stand here today. Because my thing is, I never looked at the first one. Yeah, I'm a projectionist, you know. I look way down the line, you know. I'm a cop, but you know, this first one is just a given. You know, what I'm going to do, I got all these plans on how I'm going to make all this money. And, you know, I'm one of them addicts that cop and bag it all up and then got to unbag it. You know, I don't know if y'all know that story, but, you know, that's my addiction. But prior to getting here and prior to becoming an active addict, I had problems with one is too many. And what I've come to learn since I've been here is my problem with one is too many stem from me not liking me. You know, my mother's family is originally from Washington, D.C., been there since slavery. My father's family came from the islands, and they were sharecroppers in Florida. So when those two got together, they created this human being. And they had two different identities. You know, one side of the family lived a certain way, and then the other side lived another way. So I really didn't have nowhere to fit in that I felt comfortable with. So when they split up, I was not all that mad because I was able to be put into an environment where I can at least be a chameleon in one sense of the word over there with these people. But what happened was we were living in Philadelphia. They split up. We moved to Washington, D.C. to live with my mom's family. And I had some very unfortunate incidents happen when I got there because my dad was in the Navy and we lived overseas a lot, so I spoke with a little Italian accent and proper English. And I don't think in Southeast they were real accustomed to hearing words come out the way that I was pronouncing them. You know what I mean? My enunciation and everything was correct, according to Webster, but not according to the people I live with. You know, I would say things like grandmother, you know, grandmama, grandpapa, you know, and my grandparents like that. But my other family members weren't feeling too good about that because they would say things like, yeah, I should talk like him. And you should act like him. You know, he eats his food in a certain manner. He uses this utensil for that. You know, because that's how we were raised, you know, because my dad was a military officer, so we had to put on a lot of shows. You know, black military officer, you got to put on shows when you have company come over. If the subordinates come over, your kids have to be, you know, super proper and in place. And if the other fellow officers come over, which, well, now I'm black, we had to act non-black. It wasn't said, but it was understood. You know, and today I still use those same utensils the same way, and I still eat my plate in a certain rotation and the whole thing. None of that has changed. It is who I am. But my family members didn't like that or agree to how my grandparents were trying to make them act more like myself than me act like them. So, needs to say, whenever they left the house or left the room, I didn't go through a whole lot of ridicule. They were called beatings. So, you know, I got beat up quite often in the house. So I had one of those lives where I was forced to become something other than what I was and kind of forced to see myself not to be the greatest person. You know, so I had to learn how to speak Ebonics, Southeast style. You know, I had to drop the TH and make it an F. Southeast, you know, I had to go there. You know, and I speak like that today, still. So whenever my grandparents were around, I had to speak the way I do because I had somebody that would protect me. So I thought. But as soon as they leave, you know, I get smacked around. They say, look, you need that. I say, grandma, because we ain't going for that grandma stuff. That ain't what we do around here. You understand? And then you need to know how to get some money because we don't got none. So early on, I was introduced to, you know, a lifestyle of petty thievery and drug usage and drinking. You know, when I was 9, it was a banner year for me. I used my first drug, I took my first drink, and I snatched my first purse. And I still say purse, pocketbook, handbag, however you want to do it. She was old and she couldn't run, so I was safe. But what had happened for me during that whole summer of me being 9 in Washington, D.C., is I got accepted by a group of people that it was hard for me to get accepted to. They didn't like the way I talked. I still do tuck my shirt and my pants and my trousers, as we used to call them. Put my belt on. They always say, man, you look like an Egbert. You got your shirt on in and your belt on tight. Pull that shirt out. You know, so I could never be comfortable with who I was. I had to assimilate what they wanted. You know what I mean? Because they was beating me. It was real simple. Physical pain is something that I try to avoid often. You know what I mean? And I come from one of those families that the whole neighborhood knew who they were, because it was a rack of us living in a real teeny house. And none of them had a whole lot of education, so it was a lot of thieves and petty criminals, you know, in the house. And it was like, we didn't talk about going to college and stuff like that. We talked about, you know, what house you case, what they got in there. We played games like courtroom. You know, we didn't do Monopoly because we had to understand how to do it. When you get on the stand, this is how you get through that, because that was the future that my family had planned for me, because that's what they were experiencing, you know. And I can remember, you know, being in the backyard, and I'm afraid of dogs at the point in my life, being in the backyard with the dogs, because my family used to take me out of the bed at night and tie me in the sheet and throw me in the doghouse because I was afraid of the dogs. So they're going to break me out of that and punish me for speaking the way I spoke. So I was in the backyard with the dogs, and the guys were drinking, and I wanted to be in that crowd, so I said, well, what you drinking? They said, well, you know, take this with a chaser. And I'm new, I'm 9. So I drank it, and I ran out the yard and around the block, and I came back. And they were all laughing. And I said, what's so funny? Why ain't one of y'all chase me? They said, no, fool, with a chaser, with some soda. Not nobody going to chase you. You know what I'm saying? So I had sponsorship back then. But had I known that that one drink would lead me to this podium, I don't think I would have taken it. Then it got to a point where, you know, school was about to start, and all my friends was talking about the school clothes they was getting, and we got a little list of the materials we needed for school and all of that. And my mom, she just had a lot of kids, and we got what we got. She did the best she could with what she had. So I liked the way the guys on the corner would dress when they'd be singing and stuff and see all the fancy cars pull up and they exchange dollars and all that stuff. That's what I wanted to wear, pay them to school. You know, Chuck Taylors. I wanted to pay them to go to school then. And then I wanted some Bass Weezians, and I wanted a cashmere wrap coat. I don't know if I'm taking y'all back, but that's my experience. So I told my cousin that, and he said, man, look, just when somebody knock on the basement window, you say pink or white. Okay? Real simple. Pink's is 8, the white's is 6. Get the money, and we'll give you something at the end of the week, and you can get them Chuck Taylors. So that's what I did. And then as the time went on, they kept making me stay up later and later, and I was getting more and more afraid, so they said, smoke this. So that's what I did. It was always that first one, the free one. Or so they told me. This ain't going to hurt you. Coughing and can't breathe. And they hit me on the back. And you a soldier. You know. So by the time I was 11, I was a bona fide addict. And by the time I was 14, I was a fall down drunk. But I went to school every day because I could remember things, and everybody thought I was smart. And I took this little test, and I scored the second highest in the nation, and it was in the Washington Post and all sort of crazy stuff. So, again, my grandparents were real glad for me. My mom was proud, but my siblings and others in the household didn't take to that, because that meant that they now had to go to school every day, and they would be checked on, and you need to be like him, so they just beat me up some more. So then again, I couldn't be me. I had to assimilate. And I'm not giving blame to them. I'm just telling you my story. I made choices. I could have told Grandma they beating me when you leave. But I just thought that that would lead to more beatings because I tried that one time. It didn't work out. So I stopped telling. I thought it would be more safe to just go on and continue on in the path that I was being led down. And I understand that it's my choices that lead me to where I end up being. It's not really anyone else's activity. It's my choices. So then I got in tune with, you know, choices. I can make those, but they're all centered on being driven by pain and painless, what I thought to be painless results. So whenever I ran against something that I couldn't do or felt uncomfortable with, I used. And that turned out to be just waking up. Because I would be in a house with 22 individuals, a two-bedroom house, one bathroom. We took the shelves out of the pantry and put bunk beds in there. So we'll have somewhere to sleep. That was the girls' room. Because everybody was males except for four girls. And that's how I lived until my mother got the great letter in the mail that said that she had this luxury accommodations over on Ridge Road in Southeast with minimal rent. So we ended up moving over to 37 Ridge Road, if you guys are familiar with that area. That was luxury accommodations for me compared to where I was, because we had our own place now. We were on the third floor of a three-story projects. So now I find myself in another environment with new people I can't cope with. So I used, you know. Then it got to a point where I would introduce people to using, so I would be ahead of the game. You know, I started terrorizing people so people would stop terrorizing me. And in the process of all of that, my addiction took off. But God is real good, and he saw me through school. I played ball, got scholarships, did all of that. But I could never stop using. And as I reflect back, I would say almost 100% of the failures in my life have been associated with using. Get a scholarship, go to school, tear your knee up, lose your scholarship. Well, what happened? Well, I could tell you the story about how I cut the wrong way, stepped into a little sand hole on the football field, and it ripped my knee up. But really what I must tell you is that I smoked a little boat before the game and drank a little liquor and thought that I could tackle a running back that weighed about 260, and I'm a 175, and he leads the league in rushing, and I'm a freshman. That don't all add up to a successful tackle. That says ambulance, end of your college career, go home and use. So that's what happened to my football career. You know, so I started then picking up women. I didn't like me, and she smiled, so obviously she liked me. She doing something I can't do. She liking me, so I pick her up. But see, one is too many, and the other part of that is 1,000 is never enough. I always wanted 1,000 because my self-esteem is so low at that point that one can only satisfy me just one time. So I went about the attitude of indifference toward women. And I dated a lot without care for them or myself. But I never stopped using. I got married a couple of times, had a rack of children, never stopped using. You know, it wasn't until the scorecard read zero, and I can see it read zero, that it was an opportunity to hear the message of recovery that I had been introduced to some years earlier. You know, I didn't come into the rooms and all that. I had a spouse who came into the rooms, and she got clean. But they told her in treatment, don't go home to him, because you can't live with a person using and selling drugs. That's not conducive to your recovery. But I kind of talked her into, you know, it's going to be all right. I ain't going to do it at home, mama. Give your space. But the day she came home, I was using. And I didn't see no reason to stop because she had the problem. I didn't. So she started going to meetings and stuff, and people would pick her up, and guys would come by, and I would sick the dogs on them and throw rocks at their cars and shoot guns at them. Just crazy stuff because they was telling her to leave me, and I couldn't understand. They didn't know me. Y'all didn't know me. Y'all don't know where I come from, what I went through. How you going to tell her to leave me? So I just went on and got another girlfriend. Had nothing to do with staying clean, you know, and eventually, you know, she left. I chased her in here. I went to my grandmother and I said, you know, I got a problem with this life I'm leading. She said, well, why are you telling me? Go get you some help. You know where your folks went? Go there. But I wasn't finished because, you know, one ain't enough. So every time I would attempt to get clean, I would always go to the strip and say, you know, I'm about to go to this junk, check in. Can I get one for the road? Can I get a free one? And they would accommodate me because they knew I was going to be right back because I did it so many times, you know. So I would get that one. And I don't know if that's the end of it. Did the tape guy leave? Yeah, one too many. I mean, I used to do this. Should I check it? They look to be at the end, but I don't know which one is which. So we're going to keep on rolling because I've done this before and I got tapes of me speaking. And my sponsor told me, don't buy the tapes that you speak on because you're already in love with your own voice. And that's closer to you using than helping yourself. So I'm going to try to have some humility here and not get mad because I can't send a tape home to folks that ain't here. Because they need to hear this message of hope. So I'm going to try to practice some humility and just keep going. Please bear with me. Because this is bothering me for real. Okay? Because I got an ego that'll fill all these empty seats. So we're going to work on that. See how he worked? He said, it ain't about you, man. Keep going. So in essence, my clean date is October the 22nd, 1993. And I say that every day to myself because I don't ever want it to change. I really don't. And I say it with proper English. I don't say October. It's October 22nd, 1993. Because, see, today I'm all right with how I speak. I'm all right with how I look. You know, when I first got here, I used to always get a fresh haircut before I come to the convention. You know, get some real soft outfits, throw all the jewelry on, and, you know, drive the best car. And we're going to wash it when we get here. Because I don't want all that Route 50 dirt on my rims because they spinning when I get here. Because, see, it was more important for y'all to love me than it was for me to love me. But after 13 years of coming down here, I understand that y'all love me just because you're here. I got to love me enough to keep coming here. You know what I mean? All the soft stuff at home. I'm not even in my own vehicle this year, which is a first for me, you know. And it's cool. It's really cool. I came down with a friend, drove his car, got a ticket. Then got another ticket because his tags wasn't right. But I'm driving. But I ain't mad at him. And I ain't even mad at the officer. I just need to get here because I was tired of driving. I came here yesterday morning, blessed in recovery. Y'all told me if I keep talking about something positive, I'll have something positive to do. I had to drive back to Arlington, do a business meeting, come back here last night. So I was here twice yesterday. So I talk. So bear with me. All right? Now, since I've been here, one is too many is still prevalent. Because since I've been here, I've gotten married again, got divorced again, had more children again. I've probably opened and closed more businesses than most people will ever work at again. I'm one of those very compulsive individuals that's trying to learn how to be better. Stability is something that I seek, but I hardly ever find. Seeking it and working towards it is two different things. Okay? I stand up here now, I have 13 children. And I'm proud to say that. Because y'all taught me that I can be all right with who I am. But also I must be responsible. So out of all 13 of them, they all live with me. Except for one. Okay? And I'm a single dad. Mamas can come and go. But them babies, you know, they stay right here. And we don't live on Ridge Road. We ain't all in a two-bedroom. We in a nice little place out in Fort Washington or down on the river. Because y'all told me I can get a castle or a hut in here. It's about my choices of how I go. So I chose to give them a better life than I had, but understanding that my life is the best it's supposed to be. Okay? They ain't all spoiled. They don't act crazy. They have proper English. Okay? They don't get beat for speaking Ebonics either. Because I do also speak Ebonics. But what I want to instill in them, I must have instilled in me first. See, it's not a do as I say thing at my house. It's watch what I do, then decide what you want to do. I've been to enough prisons that they don't have to go to jail. I've used enough drugs that they don't have to use. And I've been so far at the bottom of the barrel that they don't have to reach in and pick me up. But they have choices. If they choose to go the routes that I've been, they got the information. I'll pray and be here when they get back. Real simple. I can't go get none of them because they'll pull me out quicker than I could pull them in. They told me if I do what I got to do today, tomorrow's already taken care of. So I try to prepare them for life like you guys prepare me for life every day. One is too many. Tells me that I have to be real concerned with the choices I make. I have to have some discernment. I have to kind of like visit it, look at it, then send it past folks like yourselves before I execute on the choice that I make. Because most of the time my choices are self-centered and selfish driven. Because whatever I do affects me first. That's my thinking. But the reality is whatever I do affects everyone in my life, including you guys. So I need to share those thoughts way before they become activities. And I do that on a daily basis. I have a friend with me down for the weekend, and, you know, we've been cool and all that, but he wanted to see what it was like. And I told him the blessings of having all these addicts in one spot and how beautiful it is, and he came on down to see it. But prior to coming here a couple weeks ago, I said, I got to go to a meeting. He said, man, didn't you go to a meeting yesterday? I did. He said, well, how long are you going to be going to meetings? As long as I'm breathing, in order to stay even, I got to get to a meeting. You know, that's one where one ain't too many. Okay, I got to be a meeting maker so I can make it. Okay? Now, the moment that I feel like I don't need y'all anymore, I don't need me anymore because you guys gave me me. I came here a character, seeking character. Now I am an individual with some character. And it's a direct result of observation, and then action. I watch, then I assimilate. I've been doing it all my life. That's how it started for me. I just follow the right folk now. And I'm so glad that some of y'all are some of the same people I was following earlier. It makes it a little easier for me to follow. Because I need to be around folks that think like me, walk like me, talk like me, believe in some of the things that I believe in. It makes it easier for me to live in this recovery environment. Because if I had gotten here and you all guys were nothing like me, I don't think I would have stayed. But I've always been an inclusionist. I've always been an individual who wanted to become part of something bigger than me. And I wanted to be a member. But every place I went to, membership was so hard. You know, when you go to the federal prison system, membership is hard. Before they give you the number and you take the picture and you get on the bus, then a couple of planes and all that stuff, you got to commit a crime, you got to get caught, and then you fight the police, they hit you back, and then they give you this rough ride with these tight bracelets on, and then they take you to places that the accommodations ain't that great, and then you go to grand juries, and I'm just talking about my story. And it's about 50 people up on these little levels, and they all throwing questions at you, and ain't none of them favorable, and it just ain't good. It's hard to be a member of the federal correctional system. You know what I mean? You got to do some things to get there. But they told me all I had to do right here, you know, to be a member of Narcotics Anonymous is just to have the desire to stop using. I thought I couldn't come here until after I stopped using. But I found out through talking to you guys and doing some studying of the literature that all I needed was to desire. That was that mustard seed piece. If I got just a little tired, I didn't have to wait until I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. I could just be a little tired and decide that I don't have to wait until I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired, because I don't know when that is. Because, see, one is too many. It's for me, you know, my friend asked me, he said, you want to go to the hotel? We're going to have a meeting. You want something to drink? I said, yeah, I do, ginger ale with a lime. You don't want a beer? Nah, man. Well, I thought you had a problem with dope and crack and all that other stuff. I said, yeah, but one beer is the key that unlocks the door to not just my misery, but yours too. Because I got to sell all my stuff. Yours is next. You understand? And it ain't going to be with your permission. You know? So I have no delusion about how my addiction starts. It's the first one. So one is too many. Way before I get towards that 1,000 piece ain't never enough, that's when addiction is full blown and out of control. I'm talking about how it starts. Because see, the badness going to start real innocent and simple. It don't take me but nothing. One too many bad thoughts without checking in with my sponsors, too many. Ride down the wrong streets one too many times is too many. Having a woman at home and hollering at that short skirt at the metro stop is too many. It really is. Trust me. So I have to be very careful about the ones that I pick up. Because time I get to the too many part, I'm already destroyed. Then I got to drag all that back in here and help y'all. You know, y'all got to help me dust it off and prop it back up. You know, I've been around enough to see the misery associated with relapse. And I'm not talking about the using part. I'm talking about the anxiety and the fear and the feelings that I've talked to people that they share with me when they come back in. You know, that first day, that first week. I felt those things one time. And I really don't want to feel them again. I'm the guy that showed up at detox with no bag of clothes. I only owned two outfits, and I had both of them on. It was October. It was cold. So I had my sweatsuit on. Then I had on my slacks and silk shirt and a pair of Bally's. Not because I was trying to be stylish. First of all, I couldn't go back home because I rented a house out to a dope boy who I now had a bill with, so I couldn't go back home and change. I got tired of carrying an extra set of clothing. Plus, I needed to have that sweatsuit on so those clothes would fit. I don't know if y'all know that story, but I needed to have on a sweatsuit inside of a pair of 27-inch waist slacks. I'm 205 now. When I got here, I was close to 105. It wasn't cute. And it started with one. I didn't start. I don't know about y'all, but I never started using with a whole bunch of stuff. You know, I wake up and I say, man, I just need one. Just one. And that was too many. Yeah, you know. Or I got, you know, $20. So I'm gonna break it down. I'm going to get 10 singles and a $10 joint. And I'm going to put it in this, the 10 in this pocket and the 10 singles up here. Because I'm just going to get a 10 piece. Don't ever work. Or I take the money home and say, hold this. No matter what I say or do, don't give it to me. Then I find myself crawling on the floor trying to get past them while they sleep to steal my money. And at the end, you know, visit a relative, ring the doorbell, because, you know, I pull up, I see the cars, somebody watching TV. I can see the TV light on in the kitchen. I'm ringing the bell, but nobody answering. So I bang on the door. My hand's hurting, but nobody answers. Then I hear a voice say, we ain't home. Because they recognize who was at the door. And that's my mama's house. That's the end. You know, today, I'm going to build my mama a new house. You know what I'm saying? Because that's what I do as a profession. One of the companies I own is a builder. And I needed to do a project. And she said, you know, I want another house. I said, well, you got enough land. We can build one right there. She said, okay. Go on, do that. The same person who cut the lights out and said, we ain't home, got me building her a home. Because now I understand that one is too many. Because before she told me we ain't home, I came there one too many times begging. See, I was a coward. I wouldn't steal from mom. I needed to hold on to that one. But I beg her to death. But what I understand is I did steal from her. I stole her comfort, her love. She couldn't sleep at night, watch the news, wait for my name to pop up. I stole her affection. She couldn't hug me anymore because I was not the person she birthed. You know what I'm saying? So I did steal from her. It wasn't about the money. She'd have gladly gave me the money if I could have gotten myself together. The day I got clean, how much time? Okay. The day I got clean, I was staying with my mother, and I promised her I'd pay the rent. So I went to the construction company I was managing, and I wrote a check because I had check writing privileges, which means I was stealing for y'all who didn't get that. So I wrote a check that was just a little bit more than twice her rent because I needed some using money. And I told her I'd be back with the check, da-da-da-da. But on the way back, I seen my man and a girl with a car. And 2 days later, I had to crawl out the window at the Holiday Inn because I couldn't return the key to the front desk. I got a ride back to my mom's house, and I promised her this was it, whatever. And she politely told me, I don't know where you're going, but you got to get out of here. I said, well, it's kind of cold out there, and, you know, I don't have nowhere to go. And I gave her a sad story because I know she was going to give me enough money for one more. Because I said, you know, all the detoxes and stuff in D.C. is crowded. I heard they weren't taking nobody. So I put it on speakerphone and called over D.C. General. They said, oh, we got a waiting list. And I called another place, waiting list. I was just building my case so I can get one more day on her floor. Because that's where I was sleeping at this point. And she said, call out to Virginia. And I figured, well, we in Southeast, Simple City. I'm going to call out to Virginia because they ain't got no room either. Everybody crowded. It's getting cold. People want to come in. You know how we do. So I called out there, and this guy called. You know, he had a little feminine voice. And he said, oh, yeah, a male bed? We got one. But you got 2 hours to get here. And I looked at her, and I said, Ma, you heard what he said. I got 2 hours to get there, and you got to go to work. And I can't walk to Alexander from Southeast in 2 hours because I don't have no money. If you give me $20, I'm sure I can get there. She said, son, I'm not giving you $20. She said, but you could take my car, put some gas in it, and then drive yourself out there. I said, but you can't miss no more days at work, Ma, because, see, she had did a lot of driving around looking for me during the time she's supposed to be at work, and they put her on probation. They said, if you miss one more unexcused leave, we're going to fire you, because she worked in the emergency room at a hospital. And people needed emergency room people, you know, because some folk were going to the hospital. And I knew that, and I tried to use it. I said, well, you know, if you don't go to work, you're going to get fired. She said, son, if you get clean, I quit my job. She gave me the car and $20. So I went down the hill in the car. The car was on E. And I was like, well, if it run out, then I just go back home. Because I ain't make it to the gas station. Right? So I go down to the bottom of the hill, cop from my man. Then I got scared and I drove up 7th Avenue, Capitol Heights side, and used. Now, mind you, I left on E. I used, copped in D.C., used in Maryland. And then I drove over to Virginia, and we made it there on E. Parked the car at the detox, went inside, and they said, sit down right there, we're going to do the intake. And I found myself, and I don't know why they do this, at Alexander Detox, they got a little brown rug at the door with these little speckles in it. So I copped in D.C., smoked it in Maryland, and looked for it in Virginia. And I heard that in the meeting earlier today, but that's my story. So the nurse there said, after she laughed for about 10 minutes, she called somebody else down. They was laughing. I ain't seen nothing funny. I only had one, y'all. One is too many, right? But I was just flicking that rug, and they told me, they say, could you get up? I said, nah, man, because I dropped something down here. And they said, I tell you what, we'll look for it, but we need you to get up. Why don't you lay in there in the little room with all the drunks that the police brought in the night before and all of that and try to get you some sleep, and then we'll process you when you wake up. I went in there and it smelled of urine and vomit and all of that, and it was the most comfortable sleep I had had in about 5 years. And I woke up a day and a half later. And they put me in the last room on the top, all the way in the back. And they said, this is where you're going to be for 14 days. And a lot of things happened when I was there. I got a charge while I was there. They put me in jail, then they let me back in. I got sick. They took me to the hospital, let me back in. This God knowing for me what I can't do for myself. And it all started with one. I ended up being in that place supposed to be 14 days. It was almost 40 days now. And they tried to place me in a place for further treatment, and nobody would take me. Because during my addiction, I had got a label from the federal government that says I was incommunicable, which means that I could not be trusted in the community of human beings. So I had a total animalistic existence. That included jails, institutions, everywhere I went, you know, it was put him in a hole. Put him in a hole. Put him in a hole. That's what my addiction led me to. But those good folks kept me there. Then they sent me to a psychiatrist, and she said, be honest, I shared about everybody I wanted to kill and all of the other crazy thoughts I was having. And she said, I could call the police, they could put you on the psych ward for a week because you a danger, you homicidal, suicidal, all these cytles. You know, I said, that's what I need, another label. And all this started with one hit, right? But then she said, you know what? We're going to give you outpatient. We're going to let you go back home to your mother's apartment if she'll have you. And instead of you seeing me twice a week, I want you to see me every day of the week. We'll meet in the park on Saturdays and Sundays if we have to. So for the first 3 years of my recovery, I saw a psychiatrist every day. And as a direct result, I'm still clean since October 22nd, 1993. And I found out that one NA meeting is not too many. One NA hug is not too many. One NA sponsor, because all of you guys sponsor me when I can't get to my sponsor. It's not too many. I am indebted, as we all are, to help ourselves, to helping others. I can no longer be as self-centered and selfish, because this ain't about me. Y'all going to conduct meetings whether I'm here or not. So my job is to bring my dust bucket up in here. You know. So now one is too many is a decision. I have to decide if it's negative or positive. If it's a negative thought, feeling, association, because I can associate myself with some negativity, you know, gossip, rumor, all that stuff. Those negative things, one is too many, okay? But if I associate myself with some positivity, 1,000 isn't enough. You know, I love each and every one of you, whether I know you or not. And guess what? It ain't a damn thing you could do about it. My name is Nate, and I'm a blessed recovering addict. Thanks for allowing me to be here.